The Back Nine Boys Golf Show. All about golf, from putting to driving, from hooks to whatever. Now, here's your host of the Back Nine Boys Golf Show, Rich Stiles.
Good morning and welcome to the show. The Back Nine Boys is brought to you by Bridgestone Golf. Play the Tour B ball with Mindset Technology. By the club at Sea Palms. By PXG, you've never played like this before. By RSM, proud sponsor of the RSM Classic, giving back to our community. By Stitch Golf, dress your game, and by CJ's Italian Restaurant, voted best pizza, known for their deep dish and thin crust, and much, much more. Check out their full menu at CJsItalianRestaurant.com. One of our guests this morning is an old friend, well, let's say a established friend, Dr. Bob Jones, grandson of Bobby Jones. And Dr. Bob, thank you so much for being with us.
Rich, it's a real honor to be back with you.
It's been a while, and I know a lot has gone on. So April 17th, St. Patrick's Day, was your granddad's birthday.
It was. Would have been, had it actually March the 17th. Had he still been with us, he would be 124 years old this year.
Oh my gosh. What do you do on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, I know you remember him all the time, but do you do anything special on March 17th?
Well, normally we go down to the Bobby Jones Golf Course and we do here in Atlanta, and we do a celebration of his life. A lot of the folks who were donors to the Bobby Jones Golf Course will come down for that, and we have a big celebration of his life. This year, we did something a little bit different. We honored the memory of Marty Elgeson, who was the Jones family lawyer and also a very dear friend of mine for about 35 years.
Right.
Marty passed away unexpectedly last October, but it was Marty's vision. Marty is the one who first came to me, I guess it must have been 15, 20 years ago, and talked about how we really needed to redo the Bobby Jones Golf Course to make it worthy of my grandfather.
Hmm.
And he stuck with that vision like you would not believe. And what we have there now, a reversible 9-hole golf course, a very vibrant junior golf program, a great adaptive golf program. It's the home of the Georgia State Golf Association and the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame and the Georgia Section PGA. Has also a great restaurant called Boone's. And all of that is a real testimony to Marty's vision, and we really, really miss him. Although this year we did something special, and that is we had a wonderful portrait of Marty that was unveiled by his family, and I'm glad to say they really liked it, and I do too. So it was a great event.
Well, I think you guys have always done so well looking at history and looking at those that meant something to the game of golf. In 4 years, you're going to have the 100th anniversary of Bobby's Grand Slam wins in 1 year. He's still the only person that has done that.
That's right.
What are you working on for that, Dr. Bob?
Well, we're doing a number of different things for that. Of course, we're working with the governing bodies of golf for the celebrations that they're going to do for that year. I don't know exactly what form that's going to take yet, but I'm sure it will be something. We do have a big festivity coming up at the Atlanta Athletic Club, which was my grandfather's home club up in Johns Creek. It's also my home club. And we're going to have a big celebration there with, I'm sure, represented by all the clubs that have been meaningful to my grandfather. That will also coincide with the United States Amateur, which will take place at the Athletic Club in 2030 as well. We will be doing some commercial ventures through our family on the grand on the centennial of the Grand Slam. Again, not sure what that's going to be, but I am sure of a couple of things. We will have a few surprises that we think will kind of take the golf world by surprise and will go a long way in terms of bringing my grandfather's legacy to life for this new generation. And that's about all I'm going to say on that.
Whoa.
I'll just keep everybody on pins and needles as to what that's going to be.
Yeah, that was a great tease. I mean, that was really a good one.
Well, we'll see how great a tease it is. It's actually a 4-year tease, so we'll see if we can sustain
Well, I'm sure
it.
you can, but does it still surprise you after all the accomplishments that he had during his amateur career that he completed the Grand Slam in a single year at the age of 28?
Oh my gosh, yes, it certainly does. He had it in his mind to do that going all the way back to 1926 when he first won the double. He became the first man in history to win both the Open Championships of the United States and Great Britain in a single year. And after that point, he realized that he could win all four in the same year. And he felt that 1930 would be the optimal time to do that. And, the thing that's the most amazing about that is, he went over and he won the two British tournaments, and they came pretty close. And then he came back to the United States to his second ticker tape parade in New York. And then he went to and then he went up to Interlaken in outside of Minneapolis and won the United States Open. Now, at that point, he had three out of the three tournaments in the bag, but he had to wait from the middle or end of July when the US Open was contested all the way till the end of September, when the United
Oh,
States
wow.
Amateur would be played. So
Okay.
he had like 2 months where he had to endure everybody in the world writing about it, because by that time there was just no question what it was that he was trying to accomplish.
Sure.
There was a big question as to what they were going to call it. They did not know what they were going to call it. And I believe, now I may get this backwards, but I'm sure there's some historians out there that could and will correct me. I believe it was O.B. Keeler of the Atlanta Journal who came up with the title of the impregnable quadrilateral to represent the four tournaments. And then I think it was George Trevor who came up with Grand Slam, or that may be backwards, but either way, I'm certainly glad that the term Grand Slam, the term Grand Slam came out and not impregnable quadrilateral. That would be just a hard one to have to
Oh
get off
gosh,
the tongue.
I can spell Grand Slam. I can't spell
Well,
the
I can if my computer's working.
and then he retired a
Yes.
month later, and that's when he started to get into golf course design, and that's when kind of this little place in Augusta was starting to turn wheels in his brain at that point.
Absolutely. Tom Barrett was the mayor of Augusta at the time. I'll tell you a little story about that. There was a guy who was down in Miami. His name was Commodore Perry Stoltz. Now, he
Okay.
was about as much of a Commodore as I was, right?
Okay.
As I am, rather. I mean, I only know the only thing I know about a boat is what happens when I get on a cruise ship. That's it. And that's same with Commodore Stoltz. Commodore Stoltz built the Fleetwood Hotel in Miami Beach. It was a massive structure, and he had decided that he wanted to build another one outside of Chattanooga on Lookout Mountain, and that he was going to buy a property in Augusta, And develop that into a Fleetwood hotel as well, because Augusta was always a place where New York business people would stop in Augusta for a couple of weeks on their way down to Florida every winter. And so he found Fruitland's Nursery out on Washington Road and decided that he bought an option on the property and was going to develop a Fleetwood Hotel on that property. Well, unfortunately for the Commodore, a major hurricane came through the southern Florida and took out the Fleetwood Hotel. And at that time, it turned out that the Commodore was heavily leveraged and the deal in Augusta fell through. Well, Tom Barrett, who was the mayor of Augusta at the time, and I believe also the owner of the Bonaire Vanderbilt Hotel, did not want another hotel going on that property, but he knew that my grandfather was interested in a golf course. So he arranged for my grandfather to meet with a man from New York named Clifford Roberts and take a look at the Fruitlands Plantation. And from there, they issued an option, and they issued an option on the property, and the rest, as they say, is history. The city of Augusta never had to worry about competition going to the Bonaire Vanderbilt from Fleetwood Hotels anymore.
Right.
The thing that was interesting about that, though, is there's a lot of myth that surrounds the development of that Augusta National Golf Course. And like there are a number of people that said, well, Donald Ross originally wanted to design it, and he was so upset that he did not get that he designed Pinehurst number 2 to show my grandfather what he could have done. Great story.
Oh my
not
gosh.
True.
Yes,
not true.
Not true. Okay.
Not true. Actually, Alistair McKenzie and my grandfather had been very, very close friends since 1926, when McKenzie followed my grandfather for every single shot that he hit in the 1926 Walker Cup at the old course in St. Andrews. And so a lot of people felt like, well, that McKenzie was the person my grandfather wanted to design the golf course. Well, McKenzie was not even his first choice. His first choice was an Englishman who you probably have never heard of, but his name was Sir Guy Campbell.
Never heard of it. You're right.
Campbell was a very, very solid golf course architect who never really did all that much. But unfortunately for Sir Guy, he died before the golf course could even be out of the planning stages at Augusta. And so at that point, my grandfather reached out to McKenzie to help him with the design of Augusta National. And again, the rest is history.
Right. Well, the quote that I've found was your grandfather said, "Perfect." And
yes.
To think this land had been lying there all these years waiting for someone to come along and lay a golf course on it.
That's exactly what he said. And I can tell you exactly where he was when he said it. He came through the club, what is now the clubhouse, the manor house for Fruitland.
Okay.
And he was standing underneath what is now the big oak tree between the manor house and the first tee. And he was looking out over that vista. And he said it was the most perfect land that he had ever seen for a golf course.
And, you know,
he turned out to be right.
Yes. You know, and a lot of people don't realize that when you go to Augusta, that it is a lot of walking, and it is a lot of walking uphill more than downhill.
Oh, yes. Unbelievably so. The thing, though, that makes it a little bit easier to do is you're not spending a lot of time walking side hill.
True.
The way the course is laid out, you've got a lot of down and then up and then a lot of valleys to go through. Now,
right.
You can have some side hill lies. In fact, you can play Augusta. You can play Augusta 100 times and never have the same shots. But yes, that's right. It is an extraordinarily hilly course.
Yeah, and I've heard from some of the pros that have gone to play that very rarely is there an even lie to play on the
Oh,
golf course.
never. And in
Right.
fact, that if there's two things that I think mark golf courses that my grandfather was involved in the design, and that's, of course, Augusta National and Peachtree in Atlanta. That's true on both of them. There,
Right.
you never have a level lie, ever.
Well, Dr. Bob, it is a pleasure to have you back again, and
Thank you.
we won't make it as long next time, I promise you. But you have a great
Thank
day,
you,
and thank
Rich.
you for being with us.
All right, thank you.
Hey guys, this is Drew Kaler with Blue Tees Golf, and you are listening to the Back Nine Boys.
Welcome back. I'm Rich Stiles, and we're with Adam Shupak with Golf Week magazine. Adam, thanks for being with us after a very busy couple of weeks.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Great to be with you.
All right, I really want to start with a couple of weeks ago, PGA Tour CEO Brian rolled up, had a vision for the future. What were your thoughts about hearing about his vision?
Well, I thought he seemed very impressive, and I appreciated his transparency and the way he answered the questions from people in the media, and even went so far as to say, "Is there any more questions at the end?" It didn't feel like this was a rushed thing, where sometimes when the CEO of the major organizations talk, they take up half the time, and then we only get a couple questions. But he was willing to stand there and take whatever we were willing to ask him. And if he couldn't answer it, I thought he did a good job of just saying, "Look, we're not ready to get to this." There wasn't a lot of meat on the bone to what he had to
Right,
say, but
right.
he did give us an idea of what they're trying to do. I think what's happening is he's finding out that it's pretty tough to move this ship around and turn it in a different direction. And I think he was going to be. I think his intention was to be more of a bull in the china shop and really change things all at once. And he's realizing, 2027 may be a bridge year to what he envisions, and that it might be 2028. And with the TV contracts going through 2030, some things might take a little longer. But it at least gave us the structure of what to expect, what he hopes to have come out. And I don't think he put anything out there willy-nilly. I think he has a pretty good idea of what's going to go and what won't. Maybe there's something that he threw out there as a bit of a test balloon that he knows, maybe he can cede something to the players that they may,
Right.
maybe something that in his vision won't get passed through. But if he can get, five of these six things, he'll be pretty happy with that. So I thought overall it was about what I expected, because the word on the street was that they're not there yet. It's taken longer than expected, and that we weren't going to get, a full schedule or the type of stuff that we want to see at some point. And I think that the players need to know soon, especially if some of these things are going to happen for next year.
Right. Well, it already seems like, they're talking about less players. I mean, we've already dropped from 125 to 100, more signature events, which is going to leave even more players out of some of those events. And hasn't had any word yet that I've heard, you may have heard it, that if there are more signature events, will there be more other events that some of those players who can't get in those events will be able to play?
Well, probably the most encouraging thing I heard, and the thing that I believe all the players are going to be, or not, maybe not all, but a lot of them will be in favor of, is expanding the fields from the 70 no cut to 100 to 120, and I think it will probably wind up closer to 120. And if he does that, I think a lot of the rank and file guys will be pleased that, look, I got a more realistic chance, and that having a card is going to mean the same thing to me as it means to the top 20 in the world, who have kind of been catered to for the last few years since the existential threat of LIV came to be. And if there are 120 guys getting to play in this event, it's not going to be like it's not going to feel as much of a closed shop. If you have a card, you're going to get to play in the biggest events. And you're going to have it's just as much of a chance on day one of the season. You're going to be playing for similar value of points. You might need to play a little bit more in the other events to the tier two events to keep your card if you're not playing well. But you're not going to be sitting on the sidelines for, you know, basically 4 weeks, which is a situation coming up for a lot of guys. If you're not in the signature events or getting into a major, you kind of have a vacation for a little while. You might go play the Korn Ferry Tour. And I think they're realizing that that's not what makes the PGA Tour a meritocracy. So I think he is realizing that he's going to, I think that's one thing that all the players are going to go, yeah, that's what we want. I think he's heard it loud and clear and he gets it.
What do you think about the fall events? I mean, I've heard, you know, now last year, this year, after August, a lot of your major players don't play until January or maybe some of those other events they have in December. And then I've heard they're going to stop it after September. What have you heard about fall events, even though there's contracts out there through 2027, 2028?
I think it's, you know, we haven't heard anything concrete on that. I do think it was encouraging that while a couple of events went away, Napa and a longtime event in Mississippi are no longer on the schedule, that they added two new events to the fall. So it doesn't feel like the fall is going away. I always thought the fall really made a lot of sense as a time where if the tour and LIV could come to some sort of agreement that maybe LIV, that could have been the time of year that the LIV events around the world going up against football when you're not as focused on the U.S. could have really worked there.
Right.
But I get the sense that that's where guys are going to be fighting for their cards the way they sort of have been. I think it's just going to be more set in stone. And the one of the big takeaways from I don't know how much he really went into it during his state of the tour, but Brian Rolab's vision is to own the summer, and that means, you know, the NBA and NHL kind of wrap up in early to mid June, and so the rest of June, July, August, he feels like all that the PGA Tour has to compete against is Major League Baseball. And he likes that idea of having big events there. So I think you're going to wind up when the schedule does come out for 28, maybe not right away in 27, there are going to be some bigger events after the British Open. And it's just going to be interesting to see if he can get guys to want to play after the British Open through the FedEx Cup. Because that's kind of a time where the big names, if they're in the 50 and they don't have to worry about being in all the signature events in the future, they tend to take off the 3M Open and the Wyndham Championship and rest up before the FedEx Cup, those three big events. And then usually after that, you've got the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup that these guys will play. And then they're shutting it down for the most part in the fall, unless they've got a sponsorship reason or, you know, something to that effect. And they're going and playing a little bit for some big money if they're getting an invite to play on the DP World Tour, or they're just, you know, living their life for those couple months and having some downtime. And I think it's sort of what's been inevitable for years now, and I think it can work. For the people that still really want to watch golf in the fall, it'll be on, and in the markets where golf is a bit starved for coming there, I think it can still really work. I'm excited to see it go back to Austin this year. They have a new event in Asheville, and there's some really fun. I mean, that's really a favorite time of year for me. I end up going to Cabo and the island and seeing you at the RSM. Right. And, you know, those events still matter to these guys that are fighting and scraping and clawing, because the difference in the money between being on the PGA Tour and the Korn Ferry Tour is, you know, astronomical. So, you know, it's life or death for these guys in the fall.
Yeah. Were you surprised with Gary Woodland's PTSD reveal?
I would say yes and no, because I think he hadn't really opened up in any way like he had.
Right.
From seeing him from time to time, you could tell that he's still struggling a little bit. He wasn't, I didn't know to what extent or that it had been diagnosed as PTSD, but, you know, you could tell from talking with him and seeing him that, he was still struggling. You know, it was still a long fight that what he was going through, and that just because he was back on the PGA Tour didn't mean he was back to being Gary Woodland and life goes on. He'd had a surgery. I think there was more to it. And that was an incredible interview. I talked to him at the Valspar Championship last week, and he said that he was crying when he went in at the start. And when he came out, when he finished up, it felt like a 1,000-pound weight had been taken off his back. So it was good to see him make a cut and be, you know, sort of in the chase last week for a trophy. And in the beginning of the year, I always do this column where I kind of put some wishes for the year, what I'd love to see in golf. And I don't think there'd be a better story than to see him get back in the winner's circle. There wouldn't be a lot of dry eyes if he's able to do something like that.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Well, you were there at the players for Cam Young's final two holes. I mean, what an incredible display of golf.
And yeah, I agree. There's a guy who I'm a Met from the Met New York area, and have followed his career since he's quite a young kid. And my dad and myself both know his father from his days at Sleepy Hollow, where Cam grew up. So, I mean, I've been hearing about this kid since he's probably 10 years old, and seen him do some pretty incredible things as a junior. And it took a while for him to get to the winner's circle. Finally did, you know, last summer in August, and then to play probably the only player, I think, who stepped up and had a really terrific Ryder Cup for Team USA at Bethpage. He was a captain's pick and really played some fantastic golf. And I don't know whether it was the first win or the Ryder Cup experience, but the confidence level that he's playing with is certainly on the rise. I think, in hearing what he's been doing in the lead up to the players, some of the work that he's been doing on the mental side of the game, I think the improvement in his putting has been remarkable. You don't see too many guys go from, 140, 150th in putting all the way up to a top 25 guys very often.
Right. But yeah, sure.
That's really, to me, been the difference in him. And I think, that was pretty clutch the way he closed that out. The guys, both he and Matt Fitzpatrick, they smelled blood in the water as Ludvig Åberg kind of let everybody back in. And it was a pretty clutch back nine, especially to make that beautiful shot at 17 to set up birdie there. And then the drive at 18 the mental approach of telling himself, let's make the best drive I've ever had in my life and then do it.
Yeah.
Was a really remarkable.
Yeah. Are you surprised at some of the early play in some of these tournaments lately with Scottie Scheffler? I mean, not shooting himself in the foot, but not playing the way people have expected him to play over the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, I'm not concerned, but I guess you got to look at it and say, wow, the last time that he's had finished outside the top 20 in back-to-back events, we were wearing masks and gas was probably about, $2 a gallon.
Right.
He's just been on this incredible run. I'm a little, he hasn't figured out the driver yet. I think once he gets comfortable and makes a decision if he's just going to stay with the previous model that he's had so much success with, or if he can find one, that shaft, head, all the things that go into for these guys finding a club that they feel good with. He just doesn't quite seem to have it yet with the driver. And that's putting it, when you start missing a few more fairways, all of a sudden your iron game isn't as sharp. That puts some pressure on your short game, which then puts some pressure on your putting. And before you know it, you're a little frustrated and sure. If this keeps happening, I'd be worried. But at the same time, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he wins this Sunday. And, I think whether he does or not, he's going to Augusta as the clear favorite. And I kind of like his chances to win number three there.
Yeah, that would be incredible. Speaking of Augusta, prediction on Rory repeating back issues. Do you think that's still going to be an issue when the Masters come up? And second part of that question is, yes or no, do you think Tiger will play Augusta?
Bringing a lot there. I don't know if it's, I can only go off of what Rory has been saying, and he's saying that the back isn't an issue. I am a little surprised he wasn't playing this week in Houston, since it He played there last year, played well, and took that momentum, and it worked out. So I thought he would do, you know, I would be sleeping in the same bed and eating the same meals before if I was Rory.
Sure.
I don't love the way he's been playing so far this year. And I do think the pressure's off. I don't think if he gets up three or four strokes, he will go put us through the same roller coaster experience. But I think he got his win there. I'm not saying he won't ever win again there, but there's nothing makes me feel comfortable that this is going to be a repeat for him. It's so hard. You know, you don't see that happen very often. And right. That place is still one that's kind of confounded him. So I'm not expecting a repeat. As for Tiger, well, I think my feelings about that have changed in the last 24 hours now that he has committed to play in TGL.
Yeah.
That's a positive and encouraging sign. He still seems to be playing games with us on this. I don't know why he can't just come out and say, yeah, I'm ready. I'm going to do this or not. We got to, you know, track his plane and all this other, you know, stuff. But I think we'll find out a little bit more how he does in TGL. He's playing in this match too. And if it goes any farther, if they win and there'll be a rubber match and he's supposed to be in the lineup for match three. So we might get to see him swing a few clubs tonight. That would be a positive. You know, that's the toughest walk in golf on the PGA Tour. It would be great if he's there, you know, but I, at the same time, even for Tiger Woods, I just don't expect him to be able to come off the bench after not playing in a tournament since 2024 British Open and be much of a factor. So I just think these guys are all – there's some really good guys out there. They're all working so hard. And I think Tiger's been spending a lot of time on the new schedule and all the other assorted things going on in his life. He can't even tell us if he wants to be Ryder Cup captain or not.
Yeah, that's true. And he probably won't for a while. As always, Adam, thanks for being with us. We appreciate you.
Anytime. Great chatting with you. Keep up the great work.
This is Tracy West, Tournament Director with the Valspar Championship, and you are listening to the Back Nine Boys.
Welcome back. I'm Rich Stiles. We've got the pleasure and honor to talk with Coach Chris Hack, UGA golf coach. And Chris, thank you again for being with us today.
Oh, glad to do it.
So, 30 years, July 1996, you were hired on as the coach. And now 30 years later, you've decided that you want to spend more time with the family. It's time to do something else.
Yeah, just, you know, my entire career has been, you know, my 16 years at the AJGA and then 30 years now coaching. I've been dealing with kids 14 through 23 or 24 my entire life. And I don't know, just time to maybe do something else. I'm kind of still weighing out my options on something else to do, but I've enjoyed this run. I've had a great time. I've had a lot of great kids and a lot of great memories, but you know, some point it just had to come to an end. And I always said when I got to Georgia, my biggest goal was to leave it better than I found it. And knowing that I'm going to leave it next year with a heck of a recruiting class coming in with a team that's already good here, that I'm leaving the cupboard full, not bare.
How tough of a decision was it for you, Coach? After all this time, after all the players, all the championships, how tough was it?
It's tough because, you know, every group of kids that I recruit, my goal is to be there with them all the way through. And so I always kind of had that notion that, gosh, as long as I was – telling kids I was going to be here, I was going to keep coaching. But, you know, there just comes a point in time when, you know, things changed a little bit in our world with the NCAA changes, the transfer portals, and, you know, dealing with the NIL stuff. It's just not the same. And, you know, some of those things that you would hear out of some of these other coaches in other sports like Saban and some of these guys, it is true. They've kind of taken a little bit of the fun out of the whole deal. But at the same time, you know, I had a hard enough time, you know, with my old rules where we had to divvy up 4.5 scholarships out of 10 or 12 guys.
Right.
much less having to start now negotiating NIL deals and talking to agents and having agents, talk to you about, commercials that their kids may have to do or miss school for this, or they might not be able to come to this tournament because they're going to get invited to a professional event. And it's like, this is not the world I signed up for. And so I figured 30 was a nice number. And again, I've had a great run and I'm leaving the cupboard full. So I thought this is probably a pretty good time to exit.
Well, you mentioned the NIL. I know it's very dominant in basketball, college, and football. And you just talked about it's beginning to get into the golf schools, and it just makes your job a little bit more difficult because now the history will show very rarely will you have a 4-year senior because of all these NIL deals, right?
Oh yeah. And for years it was basically you were recruiting the kids, showing them everything you had, told them what you did. It was all the different elements of building a program. And now it's kind of over the last 5, 6, 7 years, it's the parents are much more involved, and now they can have agents, and the agents are involved, and some of them have their own sports psychologist and their own nutritionist and this and the other.
Right.
So it's,
Yeah.
and you gotta run everything by them before you can do it. And I've heard some pretty crazy stories out there, but at the same time, I've been very fortunate because I've been as always pretty upfront and honest with all the kids and the parents on how I ran things and how I did things. There was no ambiguity. It was pretty cut and dry. So I was very fortunate. I had a lot of kids that bought into exactly what I was trying to do, but those times are changing a little bit.
Yeah, do you think now, coach, that it's more of like, okay, I'd love to play for you, but what are you going to do for me? Because such and such
Oh
school offered me this.
yeah. Yeah, it's no longer about that. It's no longer about what your track record was. Again, you've got golf companies that are willing to pay these kids, and some, homegrown companies that are wanting to get involved with their kids and pay them a little bit. And like I said, all of a sudden, they're telling you, "Hey, I have an agent," before you even get out of high school.
Yeah.
And so it's just a change in the world that I don't necessarily think is for the better.
Yeah. I think some coaches have gotten out of it earlier than you have. It's just taken a lot of the fun out of it, don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I've got some great friends in coaching. Bruce Hepler over at Georgia Tech, who I've been coaching against for all 30 years, and Mike McGraw at Baylor. Just some guys who just the time. It's time. We've been doing this long enough. It's time for the young men to take over and try to negotiate all these deals.
All right, let's talk about, well, you've had two national championships, only two in UGA history. You've got to be proud of that.
Oh yeah, what I'm most proud of is that we were able to accomplish that, because it's so hard. There are so many good teams out there. And what I try to tell people all the time is, all the coaches that I deal with, we all work really hard. We're out recruiting really hard. We're all trying to do the right things. But at the end of the day, only one team's gonna win. And so
Right.
you've got to get a little bit lucky. You got to have a good team. You got to have things fall right. And for us, we were very fortunate. I think in the years that we did win, we played really hard golf courses, which really helped us with a really 5-man deep team. And then there were some years where I thought I had a better team, but we didn't necessarily win. And a couple of them, were years where at the Nationals you had to shoot 35 under. And it didn't
Right.
necessarily identify the depth of the teams that you could have, but there were still good teams that won. But I think it didn't help our teams very much. But I was proud of the fact that we were able to get there a couple of times, because there's a lot of really good teams, a lot of good coaches that never made it.
You have had the honor of coaching a lot of your alumni to play on the PGA Tour. It's something like, what, 46 wins, over $300 million that they've won.
Yes.
Incredible. Do any of these alumni stick out more than others that you've coached?
Well, you know, obviously the ones that you know, are playing well, you know, that you saw them doing the great things here at Georgia during the time. But, you know, Russell Henley was a great college player. So seeing him do well out on the tour wasn't a surprise. Chris Kirk, same thing. You know, you just never know. Again, it's so hard to get on tour, but then to sustain and stay on tour is hard. But then to win on tour is even hard. So I think when I look at our guys and I see that, you know, Sepp's won three or four times and Harris has won three or four times and Harmon's won three or four times and you know, Bubba's won a number of times and Henley's won and Kirk and Brendan Todd's won three times. Hudson's won three times. You know, the fact that they've had multiple wins,
yeah,
that really sticks out to me is how many of those guys won multiple times and have done it and have sustained very long careers out there, which is probably what I'm most proud of, is that, you know, that they did it for the long haul.
I know you and I have talked in the past, and there are several of the players, if not all, that you do keep in touch with on a regular basis, and they still call you for advice on some things. What do you think, coach, don't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I talk to Russell Henley, you know, still occasionally and love catching up with him. A lot of my players that aren't on tour that I still keep in touch with a lot, like a guy like Nick Cassini, who is a great player. I'm hoping that they'll reach down and pick him to be a Walker Cup captain here at some point, because he certainly would be deserving of that. You know, Ryan Hibble, who played for me and now is in the coaching circles out at Oklahoma. Brian Odom, who's coaching at Kennesaw State. Jason Payne, who's down at Mercer, who coached with me. You know, guys like that I still stay in touch with quite a bit. But I, you know, it's like I always say, these are like my own kids. And, you know, I've been to weddings, I've been to births, I've even been to funerals, and, you know, they're part of my family and part of the fabric of my life.
And now you're going to move into out of coaching, but you're going to be on a special assignment as an advisor. Can you give us any info on what that's going to entail?
Well, I think I'm basically going to be here just for Mookie DeMoss to lean on. You know, if things come up that he may not know anything about, he can call me and get me on the phone, and I can help him navigate it. I pretty much have seen it all over 30 years. You know, it's always kind of funny how I'll be at a tournament and coaches will start talking about, we ought to change this or change that, and I'll go, guys, we tried that 25 years ago.
Right.
And here's results, you know. So again, I think I just bring a lot of knowledge and a lot of wisdom and a lot of times where we maybe tried some changes and tried to do different things that I can give them a little bit of different perspective on. And that's what I'm going to do for Mookie, is just be able to give him perspective on what you want to do. Here's the options. And then it becomes his decision.
You've got an unbelievable class coming in for this year. Voted number one recruiting class, which includes Mason Howell, the U.S. amateur champ. What a coup. What a job you did there.
You know, having the U.S. junior champ and having the U.S. amateur champ come in and be roommates has never happened that I know of.
Right.
And to have both of those kids come in. But you know, we were very fortunate that both of them were from the state of Georgia. Both of them grew up loving the Bulldogs. Both of them came to my golf camp at young ages, and I got to know them pretty well. And so, you know, we just kind of cultivated those relationships through golf camp. And then when the opportunity arose, this is where they wanted to be. And, to be lucky enough to get both of those guys is pretty much the feather in the cap, and that's why I think leaving those guys in the cupboard for Mookie is the right thing to do.
Well, you are correct. I mean, you are leaving the cupboard full, maybe pushing out the doors a little bit with those two and plus the other guys that are going to be on the team. That's going to be great for Mookie and great for you to see what happens and see what they're going to do.
Yes, and I'm excited to see what the future holds for those guys. And you know, and our team right now is playing really, really well. And I only have one senior on this team, and that's Carter Laughlin. And so there's a lot of depth still here. One of my better players, a young man named Sung-Yop Cho, has been hurt. He's got three bulging discs in his back that he got in the fall, but he's starting to finally get well and starting to play a little bit. But he's probably going to get a medical redshirt this year, so he'll be back on the squad again next year, and he's really, really good. He was the Gary Player International Player of the Year last year.
Wow.
And I really miss him being in the lineup this year, but he's going to be another cog in the wheel for those guys.
Well, Coach, it's been a pleasure working with you and having you on the show a few times. And I know you'll do well after, and you'll be around if they need you. And have fun with the seven soon-to-be grandchildren.
Yes.
Enjoy that.
I am going to enjoy that immensely. And they're all young because the oldest one is only four. He got his first golf lesson the other day over in Birmingham, Alabama, by a good friend named Eric Eshelman. And I had to drive over to see that first lesson. And Eric, who is one of the best in the business, I just sat back and watched, and I thought that this is going to be fun watching these kids all kind of grow up playing golf.
You got it. Coach Hack, thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Rich. Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Back Nine Boys Golf Show with Rich Stiles. Go to back9boys.com for all things golf whenever you want it. We'll be back next week with an all-new Back Nine Boys at back9boys.com.